Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Thanks again for staying engaged with us on social media. Be sure to visit our YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/theyhadtogoout. Help us get up to that 100 followers so that we can stream this stuff live on there instead of trying to use multiple phones and tons of wires that we've already proven over and over we are not good at.
Yeah, welcome everybody. Thanks for tuning in to listen to us today. If it's your first time, get stoked. You're going to be excited. We've got a really good one coming for you today. And please look for us, however you found us, look for us on all the social media platforms. Give us a like, give us a comment, tell us what you'd like to see. Review us on iTunes or wherever you, podcasts. iTunes isn't a thing anymore. Wherever you find us, we appreciate all your support. Thank you.
100%. Hey, and we have a unicorn today. I've only met one other guy that has a career progression like he does. So it's pretty interesting. And that other guy didn't encompass one of these rates, which is he basically hit every operational rate except for MK, I think.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool to have him on the line and to hear his story today. And with that, we've got Mr. Chad Carlston, born and raised out of Anchorage, Alaska, raised in Fairfax, Virginia, somehow claims Pensacola, Florida as his hometown, but it works. Joined the Coast Guard back in June of 1989. It was 10 days after he graduated high school. He was with Recruit Company Golf 131. First Unit, Reserve, Port Security Unit out of Pensacola, where he drilled at the local station. Thought about striking BM. But ended up going to MSO Houston, where he got in touch with the air station and then waited out orders to East City to go to ASM. It's Aviation Survival
Men.
Back Men. In 93. Now Aviation Survival Technician. Right? We are very gender neutral these days. Well, so.
And we're very technical, too. They're technicians now.
Right, technicians. That's right. Graduated with class 61903. First air station and only air station was Air Station Savannah down in Georgia. Stayed there for about 6 years, transitioned to the reserves in 99, ended up being one of the very, very few drilling or reserve drilling swimmers. Eventually, they said he couldn't do that anymore, and they forced him to go to Station Tybee in Georgia, where he worked to strike bosun mate, which is the way,
right, it's the way
all bosun mates
really
should do it. Yep. But Personnel Service Center decided to create a new rate out of the blue, made a maritime enforcement specialist so that they could do the missile for all of the bosun mates out there.
Is that what they do?
I'm pretty sure. Okay. Yeah. Some of it's like a cross between a GM and a BM with very little coolness anymore. Sounded cool on paper,
though. Emmys, we love you. Keep listening.
Yeah, we do. We love you. I'm sure Chad's got some good stories from it.
Yeah, somebody's got to do all that work. Somebody's got to clean the gun.
Yes, I mean, you can't send people to jail unless it's on paper. Right. So the paper's important. But he retired after 20 years of faithful service back in 2015, and now works for Gulfstream Aerospace as a senior trainer. Pretty sure he trains the pilots for the Commandant's private jet.
And even if not, that's what we're going to say.
That's what I'm going to say. And with that, I'll let...
Partially
right. We're almost there. I'll let Bill ask the question.
Partially right. I trained him with a different company. Now I train the people to work on their airplane.
Okay. Those guys are even more important.
Right, right.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, Chad. Well, welcome. And the question, as always, is what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
All right, fellas. Well, just like everybody else that I've heard on here, guys, Phil and Bill, I want to start off, you know, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing with this. This is an awesome project. And absolutely, you know, thank you from a retiree, a 26-year retiree.
I missed 6 years.
We're buzzing bits. We don't math.
Yeah, my math's bad.
Yeah, it's all right. Now, hey, I was going to say, guys, thank you for carrying the torch. Because it means a lot to us. It really does. So I definitely want to give you guys props right off the bat.
No, and thank you for sharing the stories. We have on this show, I think I learned something new. So
absolutely.
I love it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, being a swimmer and well, doing anything in the Coast Guard, it's so much a luck of the draw type of thing. You see stuff on TV and you see news reports and you read the awards write-ups and you're like, oh my gosh. And then you remember, hey, that was the person that was there that day. That could have been anybody. They just happened to be on duty, you know, when this thing happened.
When you identify those people, you get in their duty section. That's how you get.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I was one of those guys that just, I had all the really oddball ones that would pop up, and as far as off duty, out driving around, you know, because we're EMTs, and our shop chief Steve Hathaway was adamant about, you guys, I don't care where you're at, you're always an EMT, you're going to have a kit with you. So we had our own EMT kits that were identical, you know, to the Coast Guard ones, and we carry them in our vehicles. And I 16 different car accidents that I stopped to where that I actually rendered aid to folks. I mean, everything from broken necks to people getting hit by cars. It became one of those things in the shop. They're like, yeah, you want to get award points, you know, go hang out with Carlson for a while, but you want to make sure you're in the car and not in the car around him. and it even happened one day. We were coming back from the beach doing a beach swim, and it was me and Gary Strebe, another swimmer, and this lady rolled her car right in front of us, and we actually had to, like, rip the door open, you know, bend the door, which was really cool, you know, extricating her out of it and stuff.
Now, when you say beach swim, you really mean you guys went surfing that day, right?
No, they were working out.
No, I tried. I was more of a boogie board guy. I wasn't coordinated enough to surf. But
oh,
yeah,
you're out of the loop, Chad. I think they just dropped you when threw out the boogie board. It was Savannah, though. I mean, I don't know how high the surf
gets basically.
There.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah. But yeah, we'd go do that stuff all day, and then we'd go to this Sunshine Breakfast place and get these big gnarly burgers and fried potatoes and you know, stuff that would kill me at my age now. But back then it was like,
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking that. Like, man, where did those days go?
Yeah, right. I know where they went. They went all in my gut.
Yep.
But anyway, so I just always had just unique, and it was this timing stuff. We were on our way to evacuate somebody in Jacksonville because one of the nuclear towers down there, you know, the cooling towers was on fire, and they're like, hey, we need you guys to go down and pull this guy off this tower. And we got halfway there and we're like, wait a minute, what are we doing?
They said tower, I was in awe for a second, like, wait a minute, what were you doing?
We're halfway there, and we're like, well, hold on, the Navy has 60s down there, they can get there faster than us. And they're like, oh yeah, we'll try that. So that's what they ended up doing. But we're going to go pull this guy off a nuclear tower fire. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, my wetsuit's not going to protect me from that stuff, you know?
Yeah, I don't, I mean, that's like, That's I'm crazy. Just thinking that guy was in a world of hurt.
I mean, yeah, he didn't care who was coming to get him. Yeah, he was kind of hosed either way. But yeah, that's one of those career changing moments probably. He probably looked like for that, a trucking company at that point, you know.
And that's like one you just, that'd be just tough to Roger up to. I want to save them all, but I don't know. A nuclear tower on fire. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to meet the guys that responded, though. Who is that guy?
I want to figure out how it caught on fire because they're full of water.
Right. Yeah. Well,
I don't know.
Because the water is flowing.
Yeah, exactly. If we'd had GAR scores back then, it'd have been like, no.
Yeah, we just threw away the sheet. The sheet actually caught fire on us.
It's actually purple. It's a new color.
Yeah. I just had odd ones like that. And I got to do some cool stuff. Everything from that to, you know, releasing rehabilitated turtles offshore to doing cover for the Olympics when they came through. To the G8 summit and working with Secret Service and us being in Savannah, we have a lot of special operations units in town. So I've gotten to work with the 160th and 75th Ranger Bat and SWCC when they came through. I've had so many cool opportunities, both in the helicopters and on the boats, you know, doing the tactical stuff. Cause I was a 240 gunner at the, on our, you know, 25 footers and stuff. So I got to do a lot of cool stuff. But as far as the most, you know, harrowing and the straight on there I was story, it was from a tropical storm that was going down off of Florida. And I want to say it was Josephine. I should have looked it up. I think it was Tropical Storm Josephine. And this was like 95-ish when this was happening. And it was bad enough that our op center up here in Savannah was actually flooding from the rain. We were up mopping water out of it, trying to make sure that everything was staying nice and dry and stuff like that. So we definitely weren't asleep. There was a torrential downpour
with a mop in his hand.
It
was bad. It was bad.
It does happen.
It was an auto. It was a powered mop.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it had to have been a powered mop.
Yeah, the lights are out. It's like, don't you ever tell anybody you saw this. Right. That kind of stuff. So this never happened. But, so we're sitting there and we're doing all that. And, of course, the phone call, you know, comes in and it's the SAR line. And I swear every phone in the guard at the time, the SAR line all rang the same. So it didn't matter where you were, that phone ringer would go off and you'd be like, oh, hey, what's that?
Yep.
And, yeah, you know what I mean. And my wife's doctor office that she worked at had the same kind of phone, same kind of ring. And there was definitely more than once that I was standing in there waiting to, like, get her for lunch or something. And that line would ring and I would flinch.
You're like Pavlov's dog at that point.
Yeah, you just need to start salivating.
Like, you know, I'm like, ah! So they call, and at the time it was, I can't remember if it was Group Charleston that was calling us or if it was D7 again, down in Miami. I can't remember. But they call and they said, hey, we've got a tugboat with three guys on it that it's taking on water in Wassabaw Sound. And we need to get you guys out there to it.
Hey, Chad, for I don't know Air Station Savannah that well. What airframes and then what's your AOR?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so we've always had H-65, the Dolphin.
Okay.
At the time, we had six of them because we also have a detachment that's in Charleston. So we have two birds on duty 24 hours a day because we cover from the Cape Fear River all the way to Port Canaveral, Florida. Out of Savannah, so that's a huge area to cover. So yeah, we have a bird up in Charleston 24/7 and one in Savannah 24/7. Okay. And we were supporting Gitmo at the time down in Cuba, so we had I never got a chance to go down there. They typically didn't take swimmers.
I've been there several times. You're not missing a lot.
Not missing a whole lot. Yeah, I figured as much. Yeah, but yeah, so with us having six birds, we had a full bird captain that was our CO as well, because I haven't picked aircraft. So we had the 65, and the pilots that we had that night, Don Peltonen and Dave Scott, both prior Army guys, awesome sticks. I could not have asked for a better set of guys up front to be on duty with that night. And I still stay in touch with these guys. I mean, I've reconnected with them recently, and it's like, hey, you know, how you doing, dirtbag? Oh yeah, great. You know,
right. It's just never like lost it was. A day. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, never lost a day. And our flight mate that night was Todd Cox, who I've also stayed in contact with. And it almost sounds like one of those Star Trek episodes with the guy in the red shirt, right? This was Todd's first duty day, getting qualified as a flight mech, and I think he switched duty with somebody else. Nice. So he had all the makings of, oh yeah, they're dead, you know, type of a thing.
And he's on duty with Chad Carlson, who,
yeah, exactly,
you know, gets the weird calls.
The luck of the draw guy.
Right.
Yeah, so we get the phone call, and we pulled the bird out of the hangar and put it out on the closest spot, you know, out on the ramp to the op center. And I kid you not, we could not see the aircraft from the op center because the visibility was 0-0 and was just horrendous. And the initial was, no, we can't go. You know, we can't see the aircraft. We are well below our minimums to be able to fly at all in this stuff right now. And at the time, we had a 110 of, gosh, I think it was the Key Largo, I think, that was down to Tybee. Of course, now it's 87. So they dispatched those guys. Well, now we're kind of listening. Of course, we're still trying to keep water up, but now we're more in the op center listening what's going on. And we hear the 110 go out, and they're calling back in and doing the reports. And at a certain point, they call in and say, yeah, we can't get to these guys just because the weather and the waves. And what was happening is that they went, the tug came through, had some engine work done out here in Savannah. And with the storm coming through, they wanted to get out of port and get back offshore. Well, they got offshore, and they lost their engines again. So they were dead in the water with the storm coming through, and it was pushing them in. And even though they're in, like, I don't know, 20-foot water or whatever, I mean, you guys know how deep the draft is on most tugs.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize how deep the draft is on tugboats. So the waves were hitting them, and they would be afloat 1 second as the wave came by, and then it would bottom out and kind of keel over to the side a little bit, and then the next wave would pick it up and smack it back down again. But they were still in, even though they were aground, they were still in really deep water, but now they're in breaking surf in this with all the stuff going on. So that's why the 110 couldn't get to them. I mean, they had the capabilities, they definitely had the crew, but they just physically couldn't get to them.
Right, it sounds like it's almost like one of the old school life-saving service cases, right. You know what I mean?
Where they're,
because they're gonna break apart on the beach, and then who knows what happens.
Oh, exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah, you'd see the line coming out, and they'd have it going back and forth, but we were still, geez, I'd say maybe a half mile out is how far out we were.
I've heard people talk about, like, grounded boats before, like, oh, why don't you just walk off? Well, I mean, there are tens of thousands of lives that have been lost right. in this country on the eastern coast of the United States.
I wish I'd thought of that.
Right?
If
yeah.
It was only that simple.
Man, if I could have just walked in. Yeah, I mean, that's an incredibly dangerous situation.
Yeah, it's not called the graveyard of the Atlantic for nothing.
Right.
So, you know. But, yeah, so, you know, we hear this, and all four of us are up there, and I can't remember if the OD was up there or not, but I distinctly remember all four of us were up there, and it's the decision had to be made, and we heard that on the radio, and Don turned around, Don Pelsell, our aircraft commander, and he said, all right, guys, they're going to be calling us, and I have no qualms at all, and I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was along the lines of, if any of us do not want to go out in this and do not feel safe going out with this, it is 100% understandable because we shouldn't be going out in this stuff. But if we don't, these guys are going to die. And that was summarizing it. And it was just like in the movie, you know, step forward, you know, everybody step forward who's volunteering. Before you can say it, everybody steps forward. And all three of us are like, well, no, we're going to go. You know, we're going to go. We got to give it a try to go get these guys.
I hope we never lose that as an organization.
I know.
You know?
I know. Yeah, certainly. And it's sad, and thinking about the time that this was in the 90s and so forth, we had some rough years. We lost a lot of crews, we lost a lot of birds, over some dumb stuff in time. So it's like, wow, did they have to be there? What happened? And in some, in a lot of ways, we had too much of the focus on, well, let's, you know, hey, burning babies in the surf, we got to go. And then something would go wrong on the way there.
Right.
So there's, you know, there's a need to sit back and say, hold on, guys, let's take 10 seconds. Let's think about this. And a lot of things did change around that time period. And that's, they started looking at more of the crew coordination, and we are going to have briefs before we get in the bird and go. And if we get interrupted in that brief covering these subjects, we have to start over again. It doesn't matter what's going on, but we want to make sure that we talk to each other and we know what's happening before we actually leave. So some things did change. Of course, that night it was, if we don't go, they're going to die. Let's go. And right, we were and I all think, on board
I mean,
for it.
If nothing else, you guys, you know, the good, I guess the counter to the, you know, the risk averse kind of people is accepting
right.
that mission, right? You weren't like, this wasn't necessarily taking your lives in your hands. You know what the risks were, right? And you,
right.
you accepted what those risks were. And now, if nothing else, I mean, the aircraft commander just laid it out for you like, hey, this is a real deal. We need to take this one
yep.
seriously. And
absolutely.
Everybody leaves with
absolutely.
That, hopefully with that mindset, right? So it's not
right.
it's not just some
yeah,
complacent, hey, we're just going to go out and come right back kind of thing.
Right.
That's why we spend
yeah,
so much time, because it is a hard thing. You know, we don't want the cowboy, we're just going to go every time and we're not even going to think about it, but we don't want to be too risk averse either. And I'm sure
exactly.
people have PhDs in trying to figure out how to do that the best way, but...
Yeah, I'd rather have the guys
yep.
that say, hey, I'll go, and then we just figure out how to work those problems, right?
Right.
Versus saying, oh, it's too risky, I'm not going to go.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And it's still something that I carry with me to this day with other things that I've done and other people I've worked with, and especially switching over to the boat side, because they don't always get that. You know, they don't always get that dire of a, you know, wow, this is what's happening, and wow, these people are going to die and stuff. But we did have a, you know, just kind of getting sidetracked a little bit. We did have this medical emergency when I was on the 25, and I wasn't on the duty crew, but they're like, Carlson, dude, you know, go grab the bag. We want you to come with us on this because this is what's going on. This dude impaled himself with an anchor.
Oof.
Yeah, he was a Navy guy driving a boat, and to free his anchor, instead of, you know, driving past it, he was backing down. So when it let loose, it came flying at the boat, and yeah.
I shouldn't have laughed there because a human being got hurt. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but still, you're like, you know, knowing what you know, you're like, good Lord, Carl, what were you doing? You know, right? Job security. But yeah, the crew just went flying out to the boat, and I could see they were just like in a panic, running all over, not in a panic, but you know, they were in that adrenaline rush they don't normally get. And I went up to the cockpit, and I was like, dude, man, I was like, hey. I was like, stop. And he's like, what? We got to go. And I was like, dude, stop. I said, take 10 seconds and talk to me, and let's make sure we got everything before we go flying out there. And he thanked me for it later. He's like, yeah. He said, I got so wrapped up around what was happening, I didn't even realize things was going on. And
hey,
it's just
probably taught him a huge lesson right there. 10 seconds,
oh yeah.
And we still made it. We still made a difference.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. So back to my story. Sorry.
What happened
about
to
little,
the guy?
Yeah.
I mean, Chad, you started
yeah.
the story,
oh,
man.
Yeah.
You gotta tell us.
Well, we never even started. We'll leave it dangling. Like, well, that'll
yeah.
be for next episode.
Right.
You know,
it's called a tease. I'll do
a Ryan Seacrest on you. actually, with him, where they were at, an ambulance, because they were like on the back river by a bunch of docks and stuff. So he actually got loaded to an ambulance before we even got like halfway.
Okay.
So, you know, we stood back down, and he ended up making it. And I guess it wasn't nearly as bad, but you know, somebody calls in, they tell one person. And next thing you know, it's the apocalypse.
Right.
You know, as far as how bad it gets before it gets to us. But yeah, it was still,
I
want to
see that injury.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to see,
yeah, right.
What do you look like when an anchor impales
yeah.
you? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you tell people about it?
Right.
Well, there was this time. You know?
Where'd you get that scar? We're just going to skip that one.
Yeah, so... Yeah.
I just imagine the moment of realization when you're backing down and then that thing lets go.
I screwed
it's
going
to take a little bit of time for it to
yeah.
come up and, like, realizing what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, those couple of seconds of, oh, crap. You know?
I should have took that boater safety course.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. What would the auxiliary say? You know?
Right. Oh, man.
That's why the Navy calls the Coast Guard when they need
that's,
boat operations.
True
that's right.
All right, so tropical storm, coast of Savannah, tug aground.
Exactly. So, you know, we turned it down. They called us back. If we don't go, these guys are going to die. Let's go. So at the time, the 65s were not set up to be NVG night vision goggle compatible in the cockpit. So the pilots weren't allowed to fly with NVGs in the cockpit because it had to be painted different, you know, all blacked out. They had to have all different instruments in it. They had to do all these changes to it. Well, with these two fellows being prior Army and being very familiar with that, yeah, we did some things. Well, one of them was on night vision. One of them wasn't. And there were literally times where we were using physical landmarks like road signs and stuff like that to try to figure out where we were, just because the weather was so bad. But I don't want to go into that stuff too much. You know, I'd rather them talk about that later. But so we go offshore and it's just horrendous and we are getting the crap beat out of us all the way out there because it's gusting. I want to say it was like gusting up to 60 knots at some point, which in the helicopter or any aircraft, you're getting beat around doing that kind of stuff.
What's the max wind of 65? What are the operational limits of a 65?
Oh, Lord. I couldn't tell you. Back in the day, I could tell you. I can't tell you right now, though.
Yeah, I was just curious. I didn't know if you knew. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely were pushing the envelope that night, and we definitely broke the envelope, I think, quite a few times that night, honestly.
Right.
Yeah, and I think based on some of what their limitations are now, it might be a little different. Plus, the engines we had at the time, compared to the ones now, the engines we had back then were extremely underpowered, way underpowered. And it was just part of it. We would have cases, SAR cases, where we had like a boat taking on water, especially if it was in the summer. They would have to decide, do we want to take the pump or do we want to take the swimmer? Because we can't take both because we'll be overloaded.
Yeah, I remember that being like a persistent problem. You never knew how many people could be hoisted, what gear could we bring. Yeah, it was always an issue.
Exactly. And there were many a time where it was a co-pilot would get lowered down to a shrimp boat or something to operate the pump. So we always held annual pump training for everybody. So everybody knew how to operate the P1s and so forth in case they ever had to. So here we are flying offshore, you know, at night in all this gnarly weather, underpowered helicopter, and just trying to find these guys. And we did find them. You know, we did find this tug. And the main deck, I guess you could call it the well deck, you know, the main deck was basically underwater most of the time. But then it would get picked up and then come back down, and then a wave would come up over top. And so it had the main deck, and then it had, like, the next deck up where it would be, like, they go in, kind of into the engine room and so forth. Then it had the pilot house on top of that. And there were some times where only the pilot house was visible. And we're like, oh my gosh, you know, are these guys actually still on the boat, or are they off of it? Are they in a raft? Yeah, if they're in the water, or, you know, we've lost them, and so forth. And it turns out the three of them were still on the boat, and they're in the pilot house. When we get out there to them, and I don't remember if we had radio comms with them or not. I can't remember. So we set up, and with that kind of those kind of sea state and stuff, there was no way in the world I was going in the water to get these guys, you know, lower me down the water and get me to swim over to it. That was not happening. That would have never succeeded, and it would have been dangerous for me alone. So we decided to do direct pickups. And what a direct pickup is we stay attached to the cable, you know, we're in our harness, and we go down and we have a rescue strop that we put around the survivor. And then we bear hug him, grab hold of him, we come up together. And they're usually, like, their head would be just below our chest, so they come up a little bit lower. And that's how we bring them up. And it's by far the fastest way to get somebody. That's how they started doing a lot of the initial cliff rescues before we got into more advanced stuff. And sometimes it would go wrong because we weren't really trained for that kind of stuff yet. But that was the best way to pick these guys up. It was just one at a time.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a five-story museum.
And here's our favorite five. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Snatch them really fast. That was the safest way for them, safest way for us. And so they're trying to time it. They're lowering me down on the cable with these waves coming by that are picking up this big old tug and whipping it back and forth, side to side and forwards and backwards as we are getting blown around with 30 knot winds constant, you know, gusting up to whatever they were and getting blown everywhere. And it was just, I know the first couple of attempts, they couldn't even get me down to the boat.
How are you feeling at that moment, Chad? Like, I mean, I don't know. I've never done it, right? I've never come down out of the helo into just chaos.
They talk about all the training kicks in and you just kind of go into a mode. You go into a mode, and most of the time, you're kind of not thinking about it. Obviously, you're paying attention to what's going on, and you're working on your training or relying on your training and what you're trying to do. But in that case, it was, oh my gosh, holy cow, is this going to work? What's going to go wrong? What could happen? Am I going to go home tonight? Am I going to see my wife? You know, that kind of stuff. It was just bad.
And what are you aiming for as you go down? So the pilot house, I'm guessing, is a lot more narrow than the deck, right? So aiming to land on? Like, where are you going to get your footing?
Well, so the mech is doing all the aiming at that point. Todd Cox, he's the one that's doing everything. I have no control coming down. The only thing I can do, or swimmers, all we can do is we can give them a judgment of like altitude. Like I can say, you know, I need to go lower, or I need to come up, or I need to go in a certain direction, so we can be a better set of eyes for them. But as far as where we actually touch down, it is all up to the mech and their communication with the pilot, because they're kind of in control of the helicopter at that point. They're saying, easy forward, easy right, easy left, and they're verbally telling where they need to go on a normal case. But when they're getting blown 100 feet backwards, every 10 seconds or so, it's chaos. And I know at one point, instead of being underneath the helicopter on the right, I was underneath the helicopter on the back left of it. So I was being blown all the way backwards and swinging out the backside.
Just a pendulum down there, huh?
Yeah, where Dave Scott's looking and going, holy crap, Carlson's out the left side. And so that's when they pulled me back up. I think we tried it again. But Todd, you know, in between him and what was going on up front, and again, it was everybody was having to do a job. Both the pilots were flying. The mech was doing what they had. You know, everybody absolutely had to be on their game to get me on that boat, because they put me down in a spot that was maybe, I don't know, it seemed like it was like 2 foot by 2 foot. I know it was bigger than that. It was probably, I don't know, 5 feet by 5 feet, because they also had a generator that was strapped to the deck, you know, that was up there, like one of those with the wheels on it and stuff, you know, big generator. And that strap's going to come into play here in a minute. That's how I remember it. So he gets me down there, and the first guy comes out of the pilot house, so we must have been in radio communications with him to kind of tell him at least what we were doing. So the first guy comes out, I slap the strap around him, and we're going up. And, you know, I'm ready for pickup, and then I'm watching the cable, because wherever the cable is, that's where the helicopter is. You know, I want it to be straight up and down in front of me, because that's the best thing. But when that cable's like, you know, cocked off 45 degrees to one side and it starts going tight, you're like, oh crap, I'm in for a ride, because the helicopter's over there and they're about to pull us just to get us off and pull us across the railing and all this. And so the first one went smooth, I guess you could say. I mean, there wasn't, compared to the other ones, it went smooth.
It's all relative, right?
Yeah, it was all relative at the moment. It was like, oh, holy cow, let's get us out of here. So we got him up. Second one came down, and the guy comes out, and I've got him, and I'm working to put the strap over him, and a wave broke over the whole thing and came over top out of nowhere. I mean, broke over the top of everything. And I remember that strap being there, because I grabbed hold of that strap that was holding down the generator and grabbed hold of him as we were going off the side of it. And that's how I remember that strap being there, because that's all I could think of, because I didn't have him in anything. It was just me holding on to him. And if we'd have both went over the side, it was going to be dangerous, bad enough for me being in that water with what was going on, and it'd have been over for him, because he didn't even have, these guys didn't have life vests or anything. So I don't know how, but just sheer grace that it worked out okay. And when the water got past, we're both there, and I got him up as fast as I could, and we got on that, you know, we got strapped in as fast as we could, and it's like, get me the heck off this deck before this happens again.
Right, moving with a little quickness, I bet.
Right, a little pep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. So then we go up, and so now it comes down, you know, the captain's going last, and he's a big fella. Now, at the time, I was like 130 pounds soaking wet, and considering I was soaking wet, I was 130 pounds. Yeah, I wasn't exactly a big guy. And this tugboat captain, he was corn fed. He was a big fella. And so I get him, and we're heading up, and I don't know if we just got blown around. I don't know what happened, but we get up to the door, and he starts panicking as we get up to the door on the helicopter. And you guys have worked with the 65s before, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, so if you've been up to them at any of the events or the air station, to where you see how close the aircraft commander, the right seat, is when he's sitting, how close he is to the door.
Right.
Yeah. It's not right? A big helicopter.
Yeah, so, no, it's not a big helicopter. You know, if we have to change wetsuits in the helicopter, you're basically buying somebody a drink and a smoke afterwards. You know, that kind of thing. It's like, hey, you know, sorry, but I got to get naked back here. Which gets even more interesting when you have female crew members up front. You're like, well, it is what it is. I got to do what I got to do.
Eyes forward, ma'am.
Right. What more can you say?
Yeah, eyes front, you know. hey, my mask is up here. Thank you very much. You know.
Only a swimmer would have that problem.
Sounds like you've used that one before.
I know.
Remind me of a side story about that, but I'll talk about that another time. So anyway, so we get up the door, and he starts panicking, and when we bring people in the helicopter, we as a swimmer, we're facing the helicopter, they come in back first, so the mech can reach out, grab hold of them, and pull them in, and we're kind of somewhat in control. So this big old fella just starts wigging out and starts grabbing all over the place. I don't know if he felt like he was falling out of the strap or whatever, and he reaches back and grabs hold of my pilot, who's the only thing keeping us alive right now,
right,
with what's going on. And I went to, like, you know, full blurred out rage beast mode. How dare you touch my ride home? And just, like, grabbed hold of the dude. And Todd's, like, paying out the slack. And I push him down on his back. And I get up on top of him and, you know, shove my knees up in his armpits and wail on him a couple times because he's panicking. And I had to get a little colorful with him with my instructions. So I'll just kind of save that as what you might consider as far as what I needed him to, you know, blank and do, and needed him to blank and stop and get in the blanking part of the helicopter and stuff. And so we got him calmed down and got him back there and, you know, got everything buttoned up. And now we got to get home after all this stuff and come back. And the ride back was just as bad, if not worse. I think the weather was actually worse coming back. You know, had we waited and had that phone call come in any later, it might have been one of those situations where we couldn't even got out to them in the first place, because how bad it deteriorated.
Did the survivors calm down on the way back? I mean, I know he was kind of calm once you finally got
him into
the...
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it was pretty quiet.
I think it set in, and of course I got these three big old guys, you know, in the back of this thing, and they're all soaked, and I'm just, you know, making sure they're okay, and I got my headset on and my gunner's belt, and you know, they're all physically okay. So now I'm concentrating on the bird and what's going on, because we're getting thrown everywhere and bouncing all over the place and getting pulled. I mean, you can feel it going side to side, and I can feel us losing altitude just because of microbursts or whatever was happening, and just getting, oh my God, the crap beat out of us. And I can't see squat. I'm not on MVGs, just, you know, they're just up on the MVGs up front trying to see what's going on. And, you know, calling out, hey, we're feet dry. So I'm like, okay, well, we're over land, which has its pluses and minuses if something goes wrong. And the weather was so bad that they lost power on parts of Hunter Army Airfield, which is where we were stationed. So there was some very critical navigation equipment that wasn't working for us to find Hunter. You know, basically, if you could think of that, you know, that signal beacon that says, hey, here we are, come find us, that was out. So we didn't have instrument navigation to get back, and it came down to
road
actually
trucks.
Finding, finding landmarks. So, yeah, we found, and I can remember to this day, it was either it was the service center sign, or service merchandise. I'm sorry, service merchandise, or it was the Toys R Us sign. It's on Eisenhower, which lines up pretty much with the end of the runway. And we're hovering down this road. Of course, there's no cars or anything out because of the storm. And we're hovering down this road at like 200 feet just trying to see landmarks as we're getting blown all over the place. And it's like, if we have to, we're going to land in a parking lot, you know, just to be safe. And they're like, yep, hey, look, the stores are up. And it's like, okay, I know where we're at. So that's, they kind of, you know, got that bearing to them as to where we are, where we need to get to come back in and land.
All those trips for Christmas finally paid off, right? Like all that money you spent there, like finally paid off.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And when they shut that, you know, when they shut everything down and that sign's gone, you know, I drive by there occasionally and I'm like, you know, hey, that sign meant a lot to me.
Yeah. That thing got me home. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. That meant a lot to us.
You should buy the Toys R Us sign. Everybody wants to buy
it. Yeah. Yeah. We should have put it up at the air station.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. If they'd only known. But, so we get back in, and oh my gosh, you know, the job that Don did up front, that Dave did up front, bring us back. They're the only reason why I'm here today, and the only reason why the four of us are here today. I mean, that is a no lie, guys. No over-exaggeration. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here, and those guys wouldn't be here, because nothing should have kept us, you know, there was nothing to keep us safe that night except those guys and the job that Todd was doing in the back as far as making sure I got up and down and keeping me from getting smacked in that boat and, you know, and everything. It was truly one of those events where everybody had to do everything. And there's times where it's like, yeah, one person, they're a little bit more in jeopardy. One person has more of a job or whatever the case is. And honestly, that was not the case that night. I mean, it really wasn't.
Well, like,
if anybody was off their game, we'd have been hosed.
Like everything we do, it ends up being it's a team thing, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes you don't realize how small your part might be, even if it seems mundane to you at the time, that you did change something, you affected something, or as we would say, that, you know, you broke a link in an error chain. There was a bunch of things about to go wrong, but you spoke up, you did the right thing, you saw something that nobody else saw, you reacted maybe to an unusual event that we're not trained in, but you adapted to it, and you kept that accident happening by breaking that link in that air chain.
Right.
Well, we were breaking links and air chains, you know, from the second we said, we're going to go or these guys are going to die. So, you know, it was really something. And when we got in, of course, we go in and land and sometimes we don't have any follow-up with folks on the helicopters. You know, we pick up people, we drop them off at a hospital. We pick up people, we drop them off in a parking lot or an ambulance or something. And, you know, we never hear or see anything or you know, there's none of that, like that full-on closure, I guess you could say. Or, you know, we don't hear any of that feedback from folks. The case that we do, it's really cool. So it's not very usual. We bring them back to our unit. And, of course, in this case, yeah, we brought them back to the unit. And I went and I took care of all my stuff and made sure I got all my gear ready to go in case we had to go back out again. And they took these guys over and got them some blankets and stuff. And it's like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning now, getting them some coffee and things like that. And by this time, the weather had kind of started calming down because it was enough where I walked across the ramp to go back over to the op center. And Don is sitting there talking with the captain, you know, this tugboat captain. And Don's a tall guy. He's like 6 foot. And of course that night he seemed like he was 8 foot tall to me, honestly.
Right.
You know. And So he's talking to this big old tugboat captain, and I come walking over, and so Don introduces me. He said, here's the fella right here. Here's your guy. And the guy's, was like, just kind of grabbed hold of me, and he's like, man, he's like, I can't thank you enough, and wow, it was just one of those moments. And Don told me later that, this guy was talking to him, the captain was talking to him. He goes, where's your old, diver fella? And he goes, well, actually, he goes, that's him right there walking over. And he said, that's him? And he's like, yeah, that's him. He goes, man, he said, I thought that guy was like 7 feet tall and like 300 pounds.
Not a guy that's a third the size of me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Not the 5 foot 930-pound dude that got up on top of him and was wailing on him. And I even said that because he said you seemed a lot bigger. He said I'm sorry. I caused all those problems. And I said, hey man, I said, don't mess with my ride home. And I've had a time, Don on the back. He goes, oh, I get it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Once he calmed down, he realized. But
oh yeah. Yeah, and like I said, he might feel like he was flipping out or something, but it definitely just added to everything. It's like, ah, oh, wow, now I got to deal with this. Great.
Right.
So, I think it really, that whole thing speaks to the crew insanely, right? Oh, I mean, like you said, from the pilots in the storm, and then I keep thinking back to this AST or the AMT, right? That's got to land you on like a 2 foot open spot on the pilot house of a boat.
On his first duty night.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, you had only been there for 2 years or so?
Yeah, I was relatively new in the rate, and I think that was by far the biggest case I'd had so far. I'd had a couple of cases.
What lesson
already,
did you take away from it?
Got my feet wet. Pardon?
What lesson did you take away from it?
Gosh. That we're not bulletproof.
Yeah.
You come out of school, how it is. You just get qualified, you're bulletproof. You come out of school, you're bulletproof. And you're not, and we're not. There's things that can go wrong. There's that time where we're are you going home again? When you put your ring on your life's finger when you go into duty, and that's something I did. Every time I went into stand duty, that's the last thing I did was put my ring on my wife's hand. And there's folks out there that don't understand that, and you guys know what I'm talking about. And when they hear about, and you hear about people talking about, oh, sacrifice and oh, this and that and this and that, and it's like, hey, when you have to do a job, and your police officers and firefighters and the other services and what we do to where that you have enough forethought to go, I want you to have this in case I don't come home tomorrow.
And it's not a lesson you learn until later, usually, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Exactly. When it's reality versus, well, I want to do this. And then you have one of those like this where it's like, I'm so glad I did that in case something had went wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
And it really changes your perspective on a lot of stuff. And talk about making, lifelong brothers that you would take a bullet for, and doing that within, 30 minutes or whatever. And then you make that bond with those people. It's just, it's certainly something I miss. It is definitely something I missed. And guys, if you stay in long enough and you get to retirement, which I hope you do, deciding to retire was the absolute most stressful, toughest decision I've ever made in my life. Because nobody does our job. Nobody comes in the Coast Guard to get for the pay, right?
Yeah, I do it for free. Well, I mean, I say that, but
yeah,
we don't do it too long ago.
Yeah, we don't do it for the money. And we all came in the Coast Guard. You guys came in the Coast Guard, and all of our brothers and sisters, came in to go out and do what we do. And that's the reason why. And it's part of you. It's what you are, and it's what you become. And when that changes, it's, and we, when you make that decision of, well, this is going to change and I'm not going to be involved in this anymore, it's tough. It's really tough. And, you know, thankfully I've been able to stay in contact with folks, and the guys I was with at the small boat unit that I went out and did some amazing things with. And being at Gulfstream, there's guys at Gulfstream that I flew with that were pilots for me, and there were flight mechs out there that, you know, we had really gnarly incidents with, and guys. And just this 2 weeks ago, an old buddy of mine, Mike Galley, just started with us, and he and I both had our last SAR cases together, because he was getting out and going to work somewhere. I was getting out to go work somewhere. And it was a medevac that we both had together that went really south and went really bad. And definitely not a you know, one of those type of things. It's like, I don't want this to be my last case, but damn it, I guess it is.
Right.
Yeah. And I see him, and I'm teaching all these folks that are coming to the company, and I'm talking to all these people. It's like 50 people sitting there. And I ask him his name. I see it, and he goes, Mike Galley. And I look at him. He goes, and you know me, Chad. And we had the moment, you know, in front of. It's like, I don't normally hug a guy and almost break down into tears in front of 50 people, but I just about did.
Right.
And yeah, and it was cool. You know, those are those moments in time that you're never going to gain back again, but you'll cherish the rest of your life. So.
Yeah, and they're fleeting and finite, right? I mean, there's not,
yeah.
You know, you're lucky for the ones you get.
Exactly. And I'm so thankful for me to have that opportunity to make those differences, and for me to have that opportunity to be with those people that I was with, whether it was our folks on the boat, whether it was our folks in the helicopter, or sometimes it was simply, I'm thankful to have the opportunity that we were there for the people that needed us. And even for the folks that we couldn't do anything for, I know that we were there for their family, and that they knew that somebody was there, at least with them, you know, when the time came. So, yeah, I'm very, very thankful to have had all those opportunities.
100%, Chad. And I'll say, you know, you never leave the Coast Guard family, right? Here you are on a podcast.
That's right.
I mean, we got a ton of junior listeners out there, a bunch of wannabe rescue swimmers. And I can say that because they want to be.
They want to be, yeah.
You better really
want
it.
Yeah, and if anybody's listening that's looking at that, and any of the jobs we do, the number one thing that's going to defeat you is your heart and not having it, you know, and that's what you got to have. And I've seen guys come through that you're like, wow, you know, it's like, you know, the Rock Johnson coming through. It's like, oh, he dropped out because he couldn't handle this. And then you get somebody that's, like I said, 130 pounds soaking wet, that just has that dedication and has the heart to make it through, because that's what we want. You know, we don't want folks out there that are going to second guess, and we don't want the folks that are going to quit when it gets tough and stuff. So, you know, that's my number one piece of advice for anybody going through any of our training, any of the military's training. First of all, you know, thank you for considering that. Thank you for taking that step. Thank you for having that dedication. But it all comes down to what you have in your heart as to whether or not you're going to get through it. And you're going to be the only one that determines, are you going to make it or not? Because you will be the only one that defeats yourself. And on the flip side of that, you will be the one that gets yourself through it. And you will look back and say, you know, I did this, I got through this, and now that makes me confident to where I know I can go out and get these three guys off this boat in these conditions because I know what I'm capable of.
Yeah, that's one of the, you know, that's the coolest thing you say, Chad, about that, you know, the lesson that you learned, right? That you realized you weren't bulletproof. Man,
right.
That's just, if you're the right kind of person for this job, all that does really is drive you to be better, to push that envelope a little bit more the next day, you know, increase the training, increase the drama just a little bit, right? So you get more and more comfortable with it. And then all of a sudden you're rescuing guys off burning nuclear power plants.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? I mean, that's how it goes.
You're really stuck on the nuclear power plant.
Man, I'm going to look that thing. I'm going to figure out how they rescued that dude. Well, hey,
yeah,
Chad.
Yeah, well, you know, I kind of look at it as like, well, maybe it's just his time. You know?
Yeah, right? Honestly. Yeah, I don't. Maybe it wasn't your fault. Just fate got you on that one.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, to do what we do, you kind of have to have a sense of humor when it comes, you know, it comes with some of that stuff. And a lot of people don't realize that. And they're like, wow, that's dark. It's like, well, hey, you know, it kind of comes with the territory.
Right. Well, Chad, we so much appreciate you sharing your story with us today. I know that we're going to have you back on soon. Can't wait for it. I do want to put a plug in for, well, I'll let you do it for an organization that you believe in.
Oh, absolutely. And I appreciate that. And really, and looking forward to coming back, with Todd and, Dave, and hopefully Don, if we can get a hold of him, to talk about some of this stuff more. But my association is actually local. It's called the Nine Line Foundation. And some folks out there have seen the Nine Line shirts and Nine Line apparel. And just quick background, it's a company that was started by two Army guys, brothers, here in Savannah, out of their dad's garage. And they have built it all the way up to this huge, you know, company that's been on Fox News as far as sharing their view and on freedom and on standing for the play, you know, standing for the flag and so forth. And they have a Nine Line Foundation, and it's spelled out N-I-N-E Line Foundation .org. And it's a nonprofit that's separate of the company that's still started by one of the brothers, and they do tons of support for not only the military community but for our local community here in the Savannah area. They have helped to support and build a veterans village that's going on, which are tiny homes that started off being built at the Nine Line Company, and now they're being built on site. And they were originally only doing 12. They're up to 27 of these small homes for homeless veterans right now. And they have it set up downtown, and they are in a agreement with Georgia Southern to teach these veterans coming in how to do aquaponics and hydroponics as a way to be self-sufficient and to learn something to do and to have something to help them with the things that they're dealing with. And it's an outstanding organization. Can't say enough about them. And again, it's ninelinefoundation.org, and it's a great company. Great company. And you can even support them by buying Nine Line shirts and saying you want to help support them by buying some of their apparel. And they even had a Coast Guard shirt at one point. I bugged them enough that they made a Coast Guard shirt one time. So,
well, very cool, Chad. And I truly encourage everybody to check out ninelinefoundation.org. Support the efforts. Mm-hmm. I know they make some cool gear. I mean,
they make some nice stuff.
I've definitely seen it around. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, everyone visit it. Yep. And, you know, Chad had talked about having him back on. We're going to try and get the whole crew on. So if you guys are, you know, if all the listeners out there want to hear the crew, it'll be our first crew episode to get a few guys that were on the same, you know, dramatic case together.
We're going to need even more wires for that one, Phil.
Yeah, we're going to need more wires, but we got some. But if you guys want to hear it, let us know in the comments. And, yeah, you know, absolutely. let's give Chad some feedback so that we can help him encourage those other guys to get on here and share us lessons learned in their stories. But with that,
absolutely.
Chad, thank you so much. We hope you have a great weekend, and we really appreciate you joining us, man. Yeah,
Chad, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate the story. Appreciate everything you're doing.
Phil, Bill, again, I'll say it again. You know, thanks for what you're doing. This is a great effort you're putting in, especially for the museum. And, again, thanks. Hey, brothers, thanks for carrying the torch and doing what you guys do.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org, that's CoastGuardFoundation.org, to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.